justify the killing, the murder, the continuous occupation, the apartheid, the genocide. We cannot justify it anymore. We either have to be pro-peace or pro-war. There is no third option. Enough is enough. So many people are suffering. And for me, many family members in the West Bank since October 7th, four cousins. In Gaza, more than 30 of my extended family. And I come here to Colombia, and what I do, I share my pain with the world. And they say, this is so painful. The war must stop. Children are suffering. The trauma is unbearable. And what they do, the American government and the extreme groups, the pro-Israel extreme groups, they want to silence me. They don't want me to grieve. They don't want me to share the pain. They don't want me to share the loss. They don't want me to ask for justice. It doesn't matter if I'm doing it in the most peaceful, non-violent way or not. They want to silence me.
You were president of the Columbia University Buddhist Association for 2 years. What made you become a Buddhist?
I discovered Buddhism when I came to America. And what made me become Buddhist is the practice of meditation and empathy that helped me with my pain and the trauma that I buried as a child. So when I came to America, for the first time in my life, I was provided with a level of safety to feel safe. And when you have that level of physical and emotional safety, the trauma starts surfacing. And Buddhism has helped me to center, to calm my emotions, and to be able to connect with the other, even my oppressors, even people who caused me harm. And this is how I started my journey and dive deeper into Buddhism until I led the Buddhist Association at Columbia.
Over these last few months, the protests that have taken place across the country, calling for the release of the detained students, like yourself, have been massive. And on April 20th, protesters gathered at Union Square to call for your release. The protest was organized by Israelis for Peace. This is Josh Drill, an Israeli-American master's student at Columbia University.
To deport someone like Muhsin sends a chilling message that peace builders are not welcome here. It derails the very path we so desperately need, and it actively stops Israelis and Palestinians from meeting. As a peace collective, we cannot allow this to happen. We cannot allow these deportations to happen. They threaten our future.
At that protest, I also spoke to the New York City controller, Brad Lander, who is running for mayor right now.
This is somebody who grew up in a refugee camp in the West Bank, saw a friend be killed by an Israeli soldier, and yet rather than turn to vengeance and pick up a rock or a gun, turn to Buddhism, becomes a peace activist, and comes here and goes into synagogues speaking about empathy.
The controller running for mayor, Brad Lander, also Zoran Mamdani, who's running for mayor, has come out in support of you. What was that like? How did you experience that in prison?
It might be too cheesy to say that I have never felt as much love and support as much as I felt when I was in the cell. I was not able to see the full spectrum of support and of love and of protest, but I heard about some of the action that was taking place. And I have to say I was deeply moved by seeing the everybody who has mobilized and protested, but more specifically by the Israeli and Jewish community in New York City and in America, really like moving and raising their voices against my detention.
Also, Judge Crawford noted his court had received more than 90 statements and letters. I understand now it's well over 100 from Vermont community members, academic experts and professors, many of them Jewish, vouching for your character. What did that mean to you, Mohsen?
It meant that I am heard, that I am being seen, that my advocacy and work for peace and for justice did not go for nothing.
All of this is the Trump administration went after you, saying you promoted anti-Semitism. What did Secretary of State Marco Rubio claimed in a memo that the New York Times obtained that your actions could, quote, potentially undermine the Middle East peace process? Your response?
I'm not sure if they actually have a peace process. If they have a peace process, let them show us what the plan is. What we are doing is we are protesting and we are standing against war. We're asking for America and for the rest of the world to abide by international law and human rights as a first step. This government has been violating the basic principles of human rights and the basic principles that international law was established on. They're violating this country's own laws, the Leahy laws. And if they are accusing
me... The former senator of Vermont.
Exactly. And what they are doing, they're gaslighting the American people. And they are pointing the wrong direction. My response to this is listen to the peacemakers who we have. Palestinians, Israelis, Jews, Muslims, Americans, everyone, and see the fact and the reality for what it is. What they're trying to do, they're trying to distract from the real issue, and the real issue is funding and supporting a genocide and dehumanizing Palestinians and seeing them as less of a value, don't deserve equal rights as everybody else.
Mohsen Mahdawi, can you talk about your dreams for the future, starting with next week? Class Day is Monday. I don't know if it was time for the 100th anniversary of Malcolm X's birthday, but that is Monday, May 19th. Graduation is Wednesday. What does it mean for you to be here in New York graduating with your classmates?
This is a long-waited for journey. This is the seed of hope that my uncle Thayer has planted in me when I was 11 years old and when I was in deep level of pain after the loss and horror and the trauma that I felt. And he said to me, he said, after the Nakba, the 1948, we lost everything but our minds and our souls. And he said, education and hope is your only way and your path moving forward, because we have nothing left. And in honor of my uncle's spirit, I continued studying really hard until I made it to this point, despite of all of the obstacles with the Israeli occupation. And now what it means to me, it means that I can share this light of hope, not only with my uncle's spirit that might be hovering above us, but also with the children who are living in painful conditions in Gaza, the children who lost their parents, who lost their friends, their family members, who have been terrorized with all of the pain and the destruction and the bombing. I tell them that there is a way moving forward, and that way is education. Education is light, education is hope, and education is the path to move forward.
You're not only hoping to graduate next week, walking with your classmates, but then you want to go on to CIPA, to the Columbia School of International and Public Affairs Graduate School, where you've been accepted. The judge in Vermont says you should be able to be here in New York to continue your educational activities.
Yes, this is also to fulfill the dream that I have, the dream of peacemaking, of conflict resolution. This is the whole point I came to Colombia, and this is the whole point why I am going to study at CIPA. The American government, as it seems to me, they don't want me to continue my education. They didn't want me to graduate, and they don't want me to get my master's degree. I also have to share that what happens at Columbia University matters for the rest of America. The Columbia University administration, as I have been witnessing it, has been participating in the deterioration and destruction of the democratic system. They are not listening to their students. The students have, like the majority of the student body, have voted to divest from war any entities that are supporting the apartheid and the genocide. Columbia University administration is not listening. And in a matter of few days, I will be walking, and I would be walking with a conflict, mixed feelings. The feeling that I love this university that has given me tools to express my thoughts and to yearn and to achieve my dreams for freedom and for justice. And the other feelings that I feel deeply disappointed by the Columbia University administration. And I know that it's going to continue to be a struggle while I am going to be finalizing my master's degree.
As you and Rumeysa Öztürk, the Tufts University student, and Badr Khansouri, the Georgetown scholar, are released, others remain detained, like Mahmoud Khalil, a judge in Vermont among those determining his fate. What is your message to those still behind bars and those whose names we don't know?
I say the same message, that don't give up, and don't give up on the idea of justice. Justice is inevitable. It's a matter of time. And don't give into despair. What we are seeing with my release, with Rumeysa's release, and with Dr. Khan's release, those are light of hope. And you will be next. And we will be able to celebrate you very, very soon. The same message that the Gazan people have been sending to us, we're gaining strength from them to see all of the destruction, almost no buildings left in Gaza, no schools, universities, that I'm going to graduate, no more universities for students to attend or to graduate from in Gaza. A painful reality. They are sending us a message that there is so much more to hope for than giving up on the idea of justice and surrendering to fear and to violence. So I say, stay strong, and we will celebrate under the sun in a matter of a very short time.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking this time to come to our studio in New York. Mohsen Madawi, Columbia University student, Palestinian activist, former president of the Columbia University Buddhist Association, was detained in a Vermont prison for 2 weeks. He graduates from Columbia University next week. When we come back, we look at the Republican push for sweeping cuts to Medicaid and the Supreme Court oral arguments on Trump's restrictions on birthright citizenship. Stay with us.
Flor de sabana germina, pecho abierto de la arena.
Flor de sabana germina, pecho abierto de la arena.
El tiempo sin voz camina, sin voz camina sobre el surco de mis venas.
By Radio Jarocho, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Supreme Court justices heard oral arguments on birthright citizenship. We'll be talking about that in a moment. But first, we're going to turn to the issue of Medicaid, the massive Medicaid cuts that are being proposed in the House. House Republicans have successfully pushed through proposals have successfully pushed through proposals for Medicaid and nutrition assistance cuts as part of Trump's budget, making his 2017 tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans permanent by taking away essential services for the rest of the country. The changes would disproportionately impact children and people living under the poverty line. The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities estimates over 14 million people could be at risk of losing Medicaid over the next decade under the proposed requirements for recipients to work, volunteer, or be enrolled in school for at least 80 hours a month. For more, we're joined by Anthony Wright, Executive Director of Families USA, a healthcare consumer advocacy organization. Tell us, Anthony Wright, what have the Republicans come to at this point? What is this bill and the level, the number of millions of people who will be cut off from Medicaid?
Thank you for having me. The proposal that passed the Energy and Commerce Committee just a day or two ago would cut $715 billion out of the Medicaid program over the next 10 years. It's literally the biggest cut to the Medicaid program in history, which would, just the Medicaid cuts alone, leave around 9 million Americans without coverage. And on top of other cuts and inaction and actions with regard to the Affordable Care Act, would leave about 14 million, at least 14 million Americans without coverage at the end of the term. So this is a massive cut. It removes people from coverage largely through bureaucratic barriers that get in the way of people getting on and staying on coverage. Things like having to reapply not just every year, but twice a year. Things like work reporting requirements tend to be so bureaucratic that people who are eligible, who are working, fall off the program, but also increased costs in terms of co-pays and just additional cuts to states and to providers that mean that will impact the healthcare system that we all rely on.
I wanted to turn to the Republican senator, Trump ally, Josh Hawley. Among those, interestingly, criticizing Republicans who want to cut Medicaid, he was speaking on MSNBC's Morning Joe.
Well, the right thing to do is not to cut Medicaid, so I'm glad to hear him say that. Manu, it ought to be just a basic foundational principle. It is wrong to cut health care for the working poor. And that's what we're talking about here with Medicaid. My state is a Medicaid expansion state. Over 20% of Missourians, including hundreds of thousands of children, are on Medicaid. And Manu, they're not on Medicaid because they want to be. They're on Medicaid because they cannot afford health insurance in the private market. These are working people and their children who need health care. And it's just wrong to go and cut their health care when they're trying to make ends meet, trying to help their kids, trying to make sure that they're able to provide for their families. So I hope that the House GOP and the Senate GOP will get the message here. By the way, President Trump has said the same thing. No Medicaid benefit cuts.
So that was Josh Hawley actually speaking to Manu Raju on CNN. This is Independent Senator Bernie Sanders calling the proposed cuts to Medicaid a, quote, death sentence for millions who rely on it. He was on MSNBC.
We're going to be looking at $715 billion in cuts to Medicaid and to the Affordable Care Act. That means, Chris, that according to the CBO, over 13 million Americans are going to lose their health insurance. And then on top of that, what the Republicans are proposing is a $35 copayment for many Medicaid recipients.
Right.
If you are making $16,000 a year, you know what? You can't afford that $35. You are not going to go to the doctor.
Senator Bernie Sanders. Very interesting that Hawley sounds like Sanders, who is a close Trump ally. What is the significance of this divide in the Republican Party, Anthony Wright?
It is clear that there's many Republicans who understand the devastating impacts that this would have on their districts. Many House Republican members have 25-30%, and in some cases 50-60% of their constituents that get health coverage through the Medicaid program, and that would be cut. A lot of Republican members represent rural areas where rural hospitals will be particularly hard hit if one of the major financing streams is cut. But they need money to pay for the tax cut that they're trying to move through.
We're talking about
order.
A $4.5 trillion tax cut for the wealthiest Americans?
Right. They're going to pay for that part by increasing the deficit, but in part by making this massive cut, the biggest cut in history, to the Medicaid program, which is, again, a key funding source for the healthcare system we all rely on. Hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, maternity wards that all are at risk of scaling back services. Some may even close as a result.
So how are you organizing to stop something like 14 million Americans from losing Medicaid?
Yeah. So again, 14 million people will lose coverage, but they have been activated. There have been letters and protests of hundreds of organizations against these cuts. There was an all-night marathon session where Democrats were proposing a series of amendments against these cuts. They all were rejected. But there was protesters in the hallways, folks in wheelchairs getting arrested. There's been protests across the country in front of Congress members' offices making this case that we should not be cutting health care for low and working class folks in order to pay a tax cut for the wealthiest and corporations. And that's a message that needs to be breakthrough in the next few days, because literally they're planning to vote on this in the full House next week.
And the Republican message, as they're trying to hone it, as they lose around the issue of giving money from the poorest to the richest, they're trying to say, we're just trying to rout out fraud. Your final comment, Anthony Wright.
Yeah, I mean, they say that they're going after waste, fraud and abuse. But if they were doing that, this bill would look very different. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has been very clear. Millions of Americans would lose coverage. More people would have increased costs in their premiums and cost sharing, both in Medicaid and through the Affordable Care Act marketplaces. And at the end of the day, we are cutting the hospitals, the clinics, the nursing homes that we all rely on. And that's why folks need to tell their Congress member what they think about these cuts in the next few days.
Anthony Wright, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of Families USA, a healthcare consumer advocacy organization. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Supreme Court justices heard oral arguments on Thursday in a case stemming from Trump's now halted order to end birthright citizenship, which is guaranteed under the 14th Amendment. The Trump administration's challenging whether federal judges can issue universal or nationwide injunctions against his orders. The case is raising alarms. The far-right-dominated Supreme Court could hand even more power to the executive branch as Trump seeks to overcome court injunctions against his many executive orders. This is Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Your argument seems to turn our justice system, in my view at least, into a catch-me-if-you-can kind of regime from the standpoint of the executive, where everybody has to have a lawyer and file a lawsuit in order for the government to stop violating people's rights.
For more, we're joined by Andre Flores, the lawyer and vice president for immigration policy and campaigns at Forward.us. Her opinion essay for The New York Times is headlined, "The Birthright Citizenship Case Could Split the Country in Two." You also have this piece, the other headline, "What's Really at Stake in the U.S. Supreme Court on Birthright Citizenship." What is really at stake, Andrea Flores?
So what's at stake is the definition of U.S. citizenship and also what it means to be an American. So American citizens, how do you prove that you are a U.S. citizen? You use your birth certificate. If the Supreme Court, grants the government this relief, if they narrow this injunction, then in half the country, the question of who is a citizen will once again be determined by the states. And, the last time that happened, that was the precursor to the Civil War. There's absolutely no plan by the federal government of how you would implement that or how you would prevent mistakes, discrimination. So really what's at stake is how we all define ourselves and to be a citizen and how we prove we're citizens.
So explain what's going on here, because two things are going on. You have the issue of birthright citizenship being debated in these oral arguments, but then you have the procedural stuff around whether judges can issue nationwide injunctions.
It's a really interesting case because there is this constitutional question around nationwide injunctions, which I've served in Democratic administrations and had policies that I've worked on be blocked nationwide, right? And that's been a burden for, you know, both parties. But on the other side, you have an executive order that attempts to reinterpret the meaning of the 14th Amendment, which has been settled law since 1898. So what does the government do? What does the Trump administration do? They actually, they don't want to lead with their worst argument, which as a lawyer makes sense to me. Instead, they did a series of emergency filings on that first legal question, which is, you know, are nationwide injunctions an overstep of a district court's authority? But by doing that, what they're essentially trying to do is find a backdoor mechanism to implement an order that multiple courts have found to be unconstitutional. They didn't argue, they didn't even defend their order as constitutional, because most would agree that it is absolutely not. And so, you know, the Supreme Court here cannot ignore that point. This is not a usual case. And I think you heard that from the justices. You know, you even heard Justice Kavanaugh say, asked, press the government on how would this even, you know, take place in 20 to 30 days, and they could not provide answers. So they are trying to use a procedural move. But in doing so, I want to point out they really picked a case that made the best support for nationwide injunctions, right? Because if you split the country in two and you have a child born in South Carolina not be a citizen, but a child born in North Carolina be a citizen, That's going to be a catastrophe.
So I want to go to, I mean, the order now blocked by a nationwide injunction. But conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh pressed the Trump administration's lawyer, the Solicitor General John Sauer, for details on how it would be carried out.
On the day after it goes into effect, this is just a very practical question, how this is going to work. What do hospitals do with a newborn? What do states do with a newborn?
I don't think they do anything different. What the executive order says in Section 2 is that federal officials do not accept documents that have the wrong designation of citizenship from people who are subject to the executive order.
How are they going to know that?
The states can continue to, the federal officials will have to figure that out.
How?
So you could imagine a number of ways that the federal officials could.
Such as?
Such as they could require a showing of, you know, documentation showing legal presence in the country. For a temporary visitor, for example, they could see whether they're on a B-1 visa, which would exclude kind of the birthright citizenship in that country.
For all the newborns? Is that how that's going to work?
So that's Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh questioning the Solicitor General, the Trump administration's lawyer, John Sauer. Can you translate that into lay terms? Brett Kavanaugh saying, what's going to happen to these babies born in hospitals around the country?
Well, as a former government official, it's stunning that they issued an executive order and then months later could not answer those questions. Because sort of as I write in my op-ed, the onus now will be on hospitals. It will be on states. Can you imagine a delivering mother having to also prove her immigration status or citizenship status in the delivery room? I think people are also underestimating like the maternal health outcomes and the fact that the Solicitor General wasn't prepared for how this would impact the community when they had filed and they treated this as an emergency. They treated it as though our Constitution, as it has functioned now since 1898, has been an emergency. So just to translate it, this government is not prepared. The administration is not prepared to do this. They just want the authority to reinterpret amendments. And you see them do the same thing for multiple amendments in the Constitution. The First Amendment, they are curtailing free speech by arresting international students. The Fifth Amendment, they are denying due process. They've disappeared over 200 people to a foreign prison. And now the 14th Amendment. And if the Supreme Court grants this relief, they will be emboldened. And I imagine we see executive orders on each of those fundamental rights. Which is why every American cannot dismiss this as an immigration case. This is a constitutional, really, test for the Supreme Court, and I hope that they do the right thing here.
Andrea Flores, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Vice President for Immigration Policy and Campaigns at Forward.us. We'll link to your piece, What's Really at Stake in the U.S. Supreme Court Case on Birthright Citizenship. Special thanks to my brother, journalist David Goodman. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
the strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.